the milk that we pour over our cereal this morning, that we stir into our coffee, that we feed to the babe in a bottle, followed by a long, good burp. Yes, that milk has an unresolved, conflicted history dating back 10,000 years. And we're going to journey through it this hour to better understand how innocent human milk consumption became a massive dairy economic engine. Mark Kurlansky is the author of more than 30 books, including Salt, A World History, and Cod, a biography of the fish that changed the world. His new book is Milk, A 10,000-Year Food Fracas. Mark, welcome to the program.
Nice to be talking to you.
So early in your book, you write that milk is the most argued over food in human history, the biggest food fight ever. What is it about milk that's made it such a target through history?
Well, I think, first of all, it's that we care a lot about it. When you really start thinking about milk, you can understand why there'd be some debates. I mean, this is a bodily fluid that we consume. That originally, it was intended to be human-produced, and then at some point, it was decided that other animals produce this. We could drink this. I try to imagine the original, you know, first time that decision was made. It's kind of hard to imagine, but it becomes obvious when you think about it that this is a pretty sensitive issue.
Well, walk us through the domestication of animals and when we realized that we could actually use their milk and drink it.
Yeah, we don't know exactly when that happened, and we don't know exactly which animal it happened with. Given that it was, we do know that it was in the Middle East, maybe Samaria, maybe not. You know, that's where written language began, so maybe it's just where it was first recorded. But it was probably, given the region, it was probably either a goat or a camel. Probably the initial reason for it was that there were some babies who couldn't get mother's milk, either because the mother couldn't produce it or the mother had died or something like that. But for a very long time, I mean, for centuries, drinking milk was not common. Milk was usually produced for making cheese or yogurt or other products, and mainly people on farms drank milk because long before we understood why, we understood that milk was very dangerous if it wasn't extremely fresh. So people who, you know, could milk the animals on farms drank it, and other people didn't. And it gave it sort of a bad reputation among snobbish people. You know, as the Romans, when they discovered that Northern Europeans drank milk, they took this as a sign of what barbarian people they were, because, you know, drinking milk was something that just farmers did.
And milk from a goat or a camel or any other animal can be very different. There is not just one type of milk. Milk has a lot of variation among animals.
Yeah, it does, because animals are very different, and they have different digestive tracts and different physical needs. And, the most common type of milk nowadays is from cows. And if you think about it, we're not really very much like cows. They have a totally different digestive system with multiple stomachs, ruminators, and it's actually a thought that of the, you know, milk producers that we have ever used in history, that the closest to the human system was donkey milk.
Hmm.
And so there's this common belief, always has been, that donkey milk was extremely healthy. Nowadays, it's only produced in a few places, mainly for health products.
You've been writing about the history of various foods for a long time. This is your 31st book. What made you want to focus on milk this time around? And at the outset, did you think there would be enough there?
Well, this sort of was an evolution that started because I was approached by a magazine called Modern Farmer, a very nice magazine. And they called me and said, could you do an article about milk? And to be honest, I hadn't thought a lot about milk. And I said, well, what about milk? And the editor was very upset by the fact that she had heard that that cows cried when their calves were taken away from them. And I, you know, investigated that, talked to a lot of farmers about it, and some said yes, some said no. Most seemed to say that it depended on the cow. It didn't strike me as a great story, but along the way, I got interested in just the story of dairy farmers and what a tough way to make a living that was, and what a narrow profit margin it was, and how all of these ideas like animal kindness and being GMO-free and organic and all of these things, what they meant to dairy farmers was an opportunity to charge more than the government recommended price for milk, which is too low. But there's a catch, and the catch is that all of these special things make it much more expensive to produce milk, which is why they're not ordinarily done. So it all becomes, for the modern farmer, it all becomes about finding the formula that works best.
Well, and that formula includes naming your cows. It also, there you talk a lot about the weaning process that goes on, and that those calves can't stick around with their mothers. What do we know about those relationships?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain, you know, animal rights dairies that that let the calves suckle. And I'll tell you, they're not very profitable dairies. You lose an awful lot of milk if you do that. And also, and this isn't just cows, but with all animals, except camels, which refuse to allow it, when you take the young away, I mean, you take the young camel away and the mother stops producing milk. But with other animals, if you take the young away and you bottle feed them, they love you. The farmer develops a very nice relationship with the animals, and you know, farm animals actually, you know, are very sweet animal. Cows and sheep and goats. Goats are a lot of fun. I love playing with goats. And you know, this relationship is based on the fact that we, you know, humans feed them milk, and if you hadn't done that, they would be much more estranged to the farmer. But also, they, you know, they would lose their profits.
Well, we feed them milk, and then they turn around later on and feed us milk. There's some type of relationship going on there.
Yeah, you know, it's. I think that a lot of people who have never been to a farm. Don't understand that there is a lot of relationship, and you know, the thing you had mentioned earlier about naming cows, and a lot of farmers, I mean, farmers who have thousands of cows don't name them, but even they name a few, you know, characters that stand out. Smaller farmers, like the traditional farms in the Northeast, name all of their cows.
Why is that? Do you know?
Yeah, it's an affection. I mean, it's the kind of relationship they have with these animals. And I remember I was talking to this dairy farmer in Idaho, in Idaho Falls, and I asked him if he named his cows, and he was sort of one of these, you know, lean Western men of few words types. And he says, no, I don't have time for that. That was the end of that. And, the conversation went on, and he sort of warmed up. He said, you know, really, most of my cows do have names. And the reason that he named them is that he would have children visit the farm, and the children thought the cows should have names. So children named all his cows.
When the National Dairy Council was formed a little over 100 years ago to promote milk, they told families that milk would make their children big and strong. We're talking about the long history of milk in our lives here on The Morning Show. Mark Kurlansky is our guide. His book is Milk, a 10,000-Year Food Fracas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it is that's made milk such a controversial beverage over the years? How do you see milk fitting into American culture and history? Does a memory of milk stand out to you? You can call in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, learn about the controversies over breastfeeding early on. It's all coming up here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Consider all the sayings that flow from milk. There's no use crying over spilt milk, calling a place the land of milk and honey, or the milk of human kindness. We're taking a journey through the history of milk with a bit of cheesy civilization along the way. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're understanding the production of milk and its uses in liquid and solid form. The new book is Milk, a 10,000-Year Food Fracas. Author Mark Kurlansky is here. You have a line to him at 800-642-1234. Does milk play an important role in your household? What questions do you have about the history of milk? You can call in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Mark, going back to the 1600s and breastfeeding, you write about how artificial feeding was rare, and this entire breastfeeding issue was an early version of the modern abortion issue, with men trying to make the decisions about what a woman would do. Can you take us back to the 1600s and what was going on there?
Well, women were beginning to question whether breastfeeding was the way to go, and becoming more interested in what they called artificial feeding, getting animal milk. And, you know, if you look at the clothing that women wore, it was very repressive of breasts. It was really striking to me how much men had to say about this. And, you know, women who didn't breastfeed, all sorts of bad things were implied about the character of women who didn't breastfeed. It became a really major controversy. But in fact, as you know, time went on, more and more women went towards artificial feeding, especially upper class and more affluent women. If you were, you know, if you were extremely poor, of course, breastfeeding was the most inexpensive way of doing it.
Was that where the wet nurse came to be and a nursemaid?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, the most acceptable alternative, I mean, even going back to ancient times, the really most acceptable alternative wasn't animal milk. It was to hire somebody, a wet nurse. And there were all sorts of beliefs about wet nurses. And it was commonly believed that a baby could acquire the characteristics, almost like inheriting, from the wet nurse. And so it was really important what kind of wet nurse you had, down to a lot of discussion about what hair color. You know, the people who thought that blonde wet nurses were better and brunettes were better, and everybody always thought that redheaded wet nurses were trouble. It's funny, there's just always been that thing about redheads, but, you know, there was a lot of belief about how character transferred, which, you know, kind of makes you wonder, well, about a couple of things. About one thing about what happens when you use animal milk. And there were all sorts of ancient beliefs, like if you were fed by goats, you would become more sure-footed and things like that. But it's also interesting because in a world where there was so much demand on who was going to be the wet nurse. In the world of slavery, slaves were the wet nurses.
Mm-hmm.
A woman, I mean, this gets into horrible stuff, as slavery always does, but, you know, it's like if a slave woman bore a child and then lactated, that made her more valuable. You could sell her as a wet nurse.
And when did we see wet nurses go away? Was it with slavery?
No. Wet nurses really kind of became out of fashion in fairly recently in the 19th and 20th century as people grew more and more accepting of animal milk. It was actually a process that began in the 17th century. And of course, the problem was that as people used more and more animal milk for children, more and more children were dying. By the 19th century, infant mortality rates in major cities like New York and Chicago and Paris and London, Boston, they were horrendous. Like something like 50% of all the deaths in New York City were children under five. This was all because of milk and the really bad milk practices in urban areas. In New York City, they had this thing called swill milk, where they would set up a dairy next to a brewery and feed the cows the slop that was left from producing the beer.
Mm.
And no hygiene. This is what led to the pasteurization movement. It was really about saving lives. It wasn't, you know, this is better for you. It was like, this won't kill your baby.
Catherine in Viroqua has a question here. Can you talk about the controversy over raw milk? It's been a big debate here in Wisconsin. And Catherine says, our family drinks it regularly. We think it tastes much better and it's richer.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's in the U.S., it's state-by-state laws, and I don't know what the laws are in Wisconsin. Here in New York, you can only buy it directly from the farm. If you look at the whole history of raw milk versus pasteurized milk, nobody really ever tried to make the claim that raw milk wasn't better. It's just the claim was that it wasn't as safe. And this is really a public health issue. Back when they were debating this, the question was, should pasteurization be imposed on dairies, or should we set up a system, it was called certified milk, set up a system of inspection to guarantee raw milk? And what was strongly felt by public health people is that certified milk would be extremely difficult, and it's just much easier to say that it has to be pasteurized. But really nobody, as the argument has gone on, some people have tried to make the claim that, you know, pasteurized milk is better, but nobody serious has ever really tried to claim that pasteurized milk was better milk, just that it was safer or more, the safety was more easily guaranteed.
Is that really the pasteurization, the point where we start seeing much more regulation on milk?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And taking milk into scientific laboratories, it was like the first food to have that kind of scientific testing. And, as state-by-state pasteurization was legally imposed, starting with the city of Chicago, where, by the way, it's still being argued. It led to a whole program of government health regulations on milk.
You have more than 100 recipes that are in your book that relate to milk, dairy, Why did you go down that path and incorporate them instead of like just sticking with the history?
Well, I often use recipes in my books, and the reason I do that is that I think that recipes are great artifacts.
Mm.
They tell you this is why I hate ancient recipes and old recipes that have been revised for modern use. You know, you want the original recipes, and they tell you all kinds of things about that society that made food in that way. And so I'm a great believer in the historic value of original recipes. And, you know, in some of my books, some of those recipes are really awful because I'm not looking to make good food. I mean, it's about history. So,
right. For
example, in my cod book, there's just some terrible recipes. When the book came out in Iceland, the Icelanders, in my honor, cooked a bunch of these recipes. It was like, oh, no. But in the case of my milk book, I mean, there's just so many recipes that I thought, well, why not do really good ones? And so most of these recipes are really good. I would urge you not to try Richard Nixon's recipe for cottage cheese and ketchup, but most of the recipes are really good.
Let's go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois, with a question. Hi, Sarah.
Well, good morning. Okay, this is one of my like favorite subjects because a lot of people don't know it, and it's that most milk you're going to buy on the grocery store shelf these days is ultra-pasteurized, which is almost a completely different thing than just plain pasteurizing, because when pasteurizing started, they did it at about 150 degrees for, I actually used to know this, I think for maybe 10 minutes, and that process is currently called VAT pasteurization, but hardly anybody does it because the shelf life isn't long. Now they do it at about 200 degrees for a really long time, like half an hour, and that's when we get milk that just looks like glue and just has no flavor. But it stays on the shelf for 3 weeks. So if you can find the VAT pasteurized milk, it's really, really good. I mean, it's like a totally different product. It tastes almost like raw milk to me. And you can get it in Wisconsin. I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but and if you get the cream line, that's like at a middle part. That's pasteurized at a lower temperature than ultra, but not the VAT. So that's just my two cents.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for bringing it to the table. So, Mark, pasteurized versus ultra-pasteurized.
Well, you know, ultra-pasteurized is, you know, some people argue, advocates of raw milk argue that pasteurized milk is dead. It's a little bit dead. Ultra-pasteurized milk is so completely dead that you don't even have to refrigerate it because there's nothing left in it. I think it's horrible, but...
That's the stuff in kids' lunch boxes and those little, those little box cartons, right?
Well, it's an example of what's been happening to milk in general is that, they keep coming up with these things that make life much easier for the milk industry. You know, I mean, just think about milk that you don't even have to refrigerate. Homogenization was to have milk that worked better for industrial processes. And the caller there mentioned cream-lined milk. I grew up on cream-lined milk. It wasn't called that. It was just unhomogenized milk with the cream on the top, and you'd shake the bottle before you poured it. And it was great stuff. And I remember as a kid when I first got homogenized milk, thinking, oh, what is this? What's happened? these things are... they're not really for the consumer. They're for the industry.
Well, speaking of the industry, can you explain how it happened that adults drink milk? Because humans, we weren't really designed to drink it after really infancy, or were we? How do you understand this controversy?
Funny thing, it shows what a Eurocentric world we live in. It's abnormal for adults to be able to drink milk. Lactose intolerance, which is treated as, you know, some sort of a disease, is what we're supposed to be. milk has a sugar in it called lactose, and babies produce an enzyme called lactase, which makes it possible to digest the lactose. And at about the age of two, we stop producing that lactase, and then we can't tolerate milk anymore. And this is part of a natural process. It's in all mammals. And, you know, the reason for it is so that the mothers aren't nursing the young forever, you know. It's just supposed to be something for that was set up for kids. And then for some reason, some people, mainly Europeans and some North Africans and a little bit in the subcontinent, stopped losing the lactase so that they could keep drinking milk. This was especially true of Northern Europeans. But it seems to expand. This genetic mutation that allows us to drink milk expands more and more. But people who drink milk don't realize that they're still in the minority. Only about 40% of the world's population can drink milk when they're adults.
And every culture has its own relationship with milk, we learn from your book. And one nomadic people with a heavy reliance on dairy products that you write about, can you talk more about them?
I'm not sure.
The Bedouins?
The Bedouins.
Or Bedouins, yeah.
Yeah, the Bedouins who were originally camel milkers and... I was really, you know, having experienced camels. I mean, I once took a trek across the Sinai on a camel, and the camel kept trying to reach back and bite my foot. They're really disagreeable animals, and I thought, you know, wow, a dairy farm of camels would be, you know, just horrible. But I actually went to one in Dubai, and it actually works quite well. And the Bedouin, you know. I mean, for a nomad, if you travel and you're traveling all the time with a milk-producing animal, then you have this food that's coming with you. And so, you know, you end up with a very dairy diet.
And so we treat, whether it's a cow or a camel, we also, you know, treat them just like the domestication of them and use that milk for... You know, whether it's going into a recipe or on our cereal, do other cultures, are they consuming it in similar ways that we are?
Well, nowadays, you know, everything, the world's just all becoming the same. But, you know, the traditions historically were very different, just as like cheese. Everybody had their own kind of cheese. And, you know, there are the yogurt cultures. Well, yogurt's a good example. You know, now everybody has yogurt, but it used to be yogurt was something in very distinct cultures. And certain cuisines, Arab cuisine, and certain Central European cuisines were very reliant on yogurt, and Europeans didn't have that much yogurt at all. I've been in Tibet where... yak yogurt is one of the basic foods. Very good, by the way.
Mark Kurlansky writes that there were no cows or cattle of any kind in America until the Europeans brought them. Goats and sheep were around, but none milked them. We're exploring the history of milk this hour of the morning show. The book is Milk, a 10,000-Year Food Fracas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you find curious about the history of milk in America? What about the history of dairy in Wisconsin? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. Who knew that Velveeta was invented 100 years ago? It was marketed as a velvet-textured cheese, hence the name Velveeta. The full-page advertisement for Velveeta in the book Milk says you can be indulgent about between meal snacks when you have Velveeta in your house. I think Wisconsinites would beg to differ there. Mark Herlansky has the history and then some in his book Milk, which does contain more than 100 recipes along with the action-packed and sometimes contentious milk history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see milk fitting into American culture and history? What do you think it is that's made milk such a controversial beverage over the years? Have you changed the way you consume dairy? What about soy milk? What do you think about how milk is marketed today? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark, let's talk about milk and religion. How has milk been used in religions over the years, and can you share some examples?
Well, the first example that comes to mind is my own culture, that I'm Jewish, and in Jewish law, you cannot mix meat with dairy in the same meal or ever on the same plate. You have to maintain separate plates, separate kitchens if you can. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking recently because somebody said, well, you know, I read your book and it was really striking to me how much food there is that has milk in it. And I said, well, you know, if you'd grown up in a kosher household, you'd really realize this because, you know, once you decide to have meat in a meal, there's like so many things you can't have because they have milk in them. But, you know, other religions have other things. Hindu religion has this whole thing about the sacredness of cows. And this has become a very big, I mean, it's always been a big issue in India, but it has flared up again because there's a nationalist government that's imposing all sorts of nationalist Hindu things, which is problematic because not all of India is Hindu, and the Muslim population sees this as an anti-Muslim thing, and it's a huge controversy, which has led to violence. In the Hindu religion, you can't kill cows. Now, this is a big problem, as any dairy farmer will tell you, mm-hmm. because it costs a huge amount of money. Some estimates are like $70 or more a day to feed a single cow. You know, you do this because the amount of money you make from their milk is more than that. Until the cow gets old and stops producing milk. If you feed cows that are no longer producing milk, you no longer have a profitable farm. And Indian law is now requiring farmers to do this, and it's devastating to dairy farmers. And, you know, they've tried some solutions. They actually have, like, homes for aged cows you can take them to, but it's a huge problem. And I should say also that India is one of the biggest dairy consuming countries in the world, and if you look at Indian cuisine, it's all dairy.
Well, when we say the land of milk and honey, we've heard that saying before. That has religious connotations.
Yeah, well, of course, it's in the Bible, but it's also something that perhaps because it's in the Bible, it keeps reoccurring in history, milk and honey, and also in gastronomic terms. There's always been, you know, like yogurt and honey, for example. Mm-hmm. It's always been this milk and honey thing.
So let's take a look at milk today, or at least in more recent times. Where do you see the biggest fights happening over milk as a beverage?
Oh, it's just kind of hard to pick which is the biggest. But, of course, there's the one that caller brought up earlier about raw milk versus pasteurized milk, which is interesting because that's been, you know, fought about since the 1870s, 1860s, the fight over what is the best kind of animal milk is still hot, and that's been fought over for 10,000 years. The fight over breast milk versus artificial feeding. Breastfeeding is very much on the rise in this country. A historical reversal, particularly among affluent people. But then there are issues like GMO food, GMO grain for cows. If you want to feed cows GMO-free grain, you're going to spend a lot of money for feed, a lot more money for feed. There's organic, and organic, unfortunately, has been defined by the U.S. government and defined in a way that makes it almost impossible for a small farm to do it. So most organic milk is coming from huge factory farms, which is exactly the opposite of what most people think of when they think of organic. Well, that's a few of them.
And we also have these CAFOs here in Wisconsin, and that has also been a very controversial thing. Let's bring in Patrick in Richland County. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning and great show. I am wondering if the author has written about the economic and environmental disaster that the dairy industry has wrought in Richland County. We're right in the middle of it. In fact, we're Dairy Central in the state of Wisconsin, and we have no grocery store in our town of 5,000. Anyway, environmentally, we just had the spring runoff. It's the same every year. The water is so polluted with cow manure that you wonder how anything can live in the rivers with that amount of pollution. And then, of course, on the environmental impact, dairying does not create well-paying jobs. In fact, some of the jobs are undocumented labor. And so I guess my question to the author is, have you covered this at all? And there's a better way to do this. The milk trucks are so big out here, they're totally destroying our roads. And so we are subsidizing this disaster.
Patrick brings up a lot of points here, Mark Kurlansky.
Yeah, and let me try to get through some of this. I have written about this. I should say that I'm currently working on my next book, which is about salmon, and I talk a lot more about this in my salmon book because, as you say, it's polluting rivers. Farming, in a lot of ways, is not good for rivers. What has happened to dairy farming is it's just become bigger and bigger, and the reason for that is the economics of it, the slim profit margin has mandated that, you know, the more cows you have, the better chance you have of surviving, and so small farms are going out of business at an alarming rate, and they're becoming bigger and bigger, and Wisconsin is not big compared to Idaho and California.
Well, Wisconsin lost 500 dairy farms last year out of business.
Yeah, yeah. You should see what's happening in Vermont or New York State. And it's unfortunate because, as the caller says, the way it should be done, the way it would have the least environmental impact would be to go back to, you know, farms of 100 cows. But it's not economically viable. You could solve a lot of problems in the dairy industry by just making milk more expensive. But the question is whether the consumer would accept expensive milk. It's interesting to see that around big cities, like around New York, for example, or around L.A., there are farmers who are doing things in really sort of special ways and charging considerably more money for the milk. And the reason they can do this is because there are affluent consumers in the cities that will pay for this.
Almost making milk a delicacy.
Yeah, well, the problem with this, it's the problem with, you know, so many things that we who write about, you know, food and the good way to produce food don't deal with is that we're making food, when you make food more expensive, you're not dealing with the question of what are poor people supposed to eat.
So as we wrap up here, there is a whole section in the dairy case that is really encroaching on milk. That is like soy milk, almond milk, the list goes on. What is that relationship like and where do you see that headed here?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it looks like a new thing, but in fact it was very common in the Middle Ages. Almond milk in particular was very common, and you know, the Catholic Church had restrictions on dairy on holy days, and so if you made your dish with almond milk instead of with cow milk, you got around those restrictions, and you know, these alternative milks in a day age before pasteurization and before any of that stuff was understood, what was understood was that almond milk would never make you sick as cow milk might. But it's interesting that, you know, all these alternatives have come back. They're not new.
Well, Mark, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Nice to talk to Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed. Mark Kurlansky is a writer and author. He's written more than 30 books, including Salt, A World History, and Cod, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World. His new book out, it's Milk, A 10,000-Year Food Fracas. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and the Ideas Network director, Cheryl Gasser. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about milk, it comes to you on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.